This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
That allows us to inherit America that looks like the America that we want.
Philip Agnew, I want to thank you for being with us. We have to wrap the show of Dream Defenders, Reverend Jesse Jackson in Chicago and Lisa Grace of the Center for Media and Democracy. And today, a fond farewell to Martina Starosta, who has been working with us as a fellow for the last year. We thank you for your persistence, your dedication, your creativity, and wish you very well in the future. Look forward to working with you as we go on. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felsar, and Martin Yermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
The time is 5 p.m., and you're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 Community Radio. Please stay tuned for the evening news coming up next.
On Thursday, July 18th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., KBOO will be broadcasting the first town hall meeting called by the nonprofit group Article 5 Convention for Our Children's Future on the issue of the national defense budget. Experts on the panel include Dr. Robert Pollan, Dr. Miriam Pemberton, and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Once again, you can tune in on Thursday, July 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. On Thursday, July 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m.,
as the planet lurches past 400 parts per million concentration of CO2, the moment has come for all of us to do hard, important, powerful things to combat climate change. The last 2 weeks of July are, statistically, the hottest stretch of the year. As part of the nationally coordinated summer heat action, Bill McKibben, author and co-founder of 350.org, will speak this Wednesday, July 17th, in Vancouver, Washington, to talk about climate change and the movement to turn it around. KBOO will broadcast his talk live.
Either Exxon has to give in or physics has to give in. It'll be hard to change Exxon's mind. I think it'll be harder to get physics to compromise.
That's Bill McKibben of 350.org. Tune in Wednesday, July 17th at 7:30 p.m. to hear a live broadcast of Bill McKibben speaking at Clark College in Vancouver.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we hear local reaction to the not guilty verdict in the George Zimmerman murder trial following Sunday's local protests.
Three Occupy Mount Tabor activists were arrested over the weekend for protesting the city's plans to cover its reservoirs.
A Georgia court has halted the execution of an intellectually disabled man just hours before his execution. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 15th, 2013. I'm Angelique O'Rourke.
And I'm John Rasmussen. George Zimmerman was found not guilty over the weekend for manslaughter, touching off mass protests across the country, including protests in downtown Portland Sunday evening. Zimmerman was acquitted of a murder charge for killing an unarmed black youth, Trayon Martin, in Florida. Some blame the prosecution for losing the case, including a former head of the National Bar Association, who said when Corey was selected as prosecutor, there was nothing in Angela Corey's background that would suit her for the task, adding that she could not command the respect of people who care about justice. But other people around the country say the problem is deeper than simply the failings of one prosecutor, judge, or jury, and the killing of Trayon Martin is symbolic of an ongoing racial divide in the country. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke today with local activist Pierre Maillot, who spoke at yesterday's rally in March in Portland, where hundreds of people gathered at Peninsula Park.
I wonder if you can talk about yesterday's rally for justice for Trayvon Martin here in Portland.
Yesterday's rally in the park had a decent turnout. I know some of the organizers were hoping there would be a lot more people, and we did kind of address this during the rally. There was not as big of a response, which is partly the reason why these sorts of things continue to happen today.
And by these sorts of things, you mean the targeting of young black men?
We have the... Definitely, like, the targeting of young black men is an issue. But really the targeting of all youth individuals from marginalized parts of society are an issue. Young black women, young black men, people of brown skin. It's not Trayvon Martin, to a lot of the individuals that were present yesterday, was likened to pretty much all of us that were there, because if it can happen to him, it can happen to any of us.
And were there a lot of young people out yesterday in Portland?
There was a good number of young people. There was a very diverse crowd, and it was very promising. We had a lot of older members in the community that were out, and their attitude, I think, was a little bit different than the younger people out there, just because they've seen a lot of this happen over and over and over again. They were trying to impress on the people there that it's good to come to a rally in solidarity, but we have to move forward from there. We can't just come here, feel good about it, and then the next day go back to business as usual. It's not to say that people that have been through more and seen more are not optimistic. They simply realize that this is not enough, that we have to start taking chances, and we have to start taking action to stop this. And sitting back and waiting for members of a system that really don't care about the individuals, and we're talking about people on all political levels, the system is not working. And general consensus there was, we understand the system is not working. We have to find a way of replacing that system. Some of the young speakers advocated getting involved in radical movements, getting involved with revolutionary parties. And that's really the only way this is going to change, because this racist system is going to keep perpetuating racism on us, and it's going to keep giving us lies, and it's going to keep having news stories that are saying, you know, people went and marched, everyone's feeling better about it. When in reality, when we look out there, we see people dying every day. The news isn't even reporting it. And we've had to bury family members. I know myself personally, I've had, you know, friends that have been shot by police. I've had friends that have been enslaved by the system. It's not getting better. We need to take action. And if you want to make a change, then you go out in your community and you start getting together with people and you start talking to people, finding out what's wrong and how to fix it.
And when you say enslaved, I'm assuming that you're referring to that section of the 13th Amendment that abolishes slavery except in prison.
Well, exactly. I mean, you can look at the prison system in the United States and you see, within years of slavery being over, the majority of people in prison were, you know, people of color, whereas during the time of slavery, there was almost no people of color in the system. People are not property. And that's the issue with the entire system, is people are treated as property. Young black people are treated as property. And they do a lot more for the system if they're enslaved, making license plates or whatever else they have us do for next to nothing. That's how we benefit the system. And that's why we need to go against the system, and we need to get rid of the system till we have a system that cares about the living beings that live within it.
Well, thank you, Pierre Mayo, local activist here in Portland. This is Jenka Soderberg reporting.
The not guilty verdict in the trial of George Zimmerman makes it possible for him to resume his lawsuit against NBC, claiming that the station misrepresented him as racist. Zimmerman announced in December that he was planning to sue NBC for libel for playing his 911 call out of context. The call was edited to make it sound like Zimmerman identified Trayvon Martin as black at the beginning of the call. In fact, Zimmerman stated at the beginning of the call that he was following a guy around the neighborhood who he thought was, quote, on drugs or something, and only identified him as black later on in the call. His lawsuit was put on hold until the criminal trial was resolved. If Zimmerman had been convicted, NBC would have been able to end the lawsuit, as a conviction would constitute evidence that any damage to his character was his own fault, and not a result of the broadcast of his 911 call. Zimmerman's lawyer issued a statement today that he would proceed with the lawsuit against NBC.
After being cleared of criminal charges for the killing of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman may still face federal criminal civil rights prosecution by the Department of Justice. Justice Department officials said today that they are looking into the possibility of filing civil rights charges against Zimmerman for shooting and killing the 17-year-old teenager. A civil rights lawsuit looks at the question of Zimmerman's motives when he followed and then killed Trayvon Martin. Prosecutors would have to show that the attack on Martin was unjustified, that Zimmerman attacked Martin because of his race, and because he was using a public space in walking on the street. The NAACP is circulating a petition urging the Justice Department to file charges against Zimmerman. In addition to the threat of federal charges, Zimmerman could also face a civil lawsuit brought by Martin's family. In April, a lawsuit against the Homeowners Association by Trayvon Martin's family was settled for $1 million. Renee Sussman spoke at that time on local news about the role of the Homeowners Association in allowing Zimmerman to patrol the neighborhood while still carrying a loaded weapon.
One would infer by his behavior the night Trayvon was killed that he at least initially was acting as a neighborhood watch person. We're not sure of the total, but we're confident it's more than a million. It essentially says we, the Homeowners Association, don't admit liability. We're doing this because it keeps us from going to court, from getting involved in a lawsuit, and we avoid those litigation costs.
That was Renee Sussman speaking about the Homeowners Association settlement with the Trayvon Martin's family. The details of that settlement remain sealed, but another civil rights lawsuit against George Zimmerman himself has been suggested. Under Florida law, George Zimmerman will now have his gun returned, the same gun which he used to kill Trayvon Martin.
One of the things that has come to the forefront in light of the killing of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin in Florida has been the Stand Your Ground law, which allows for a person to defend themselves with deadly force if they feel threatened in any way. This applies not just to private property, but also to public space. But opponents say that the law has been unfairly applied to target minority youth. The so-called Stand Your Ground law is actually a product of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which is a group that's funded by some of the biggest corporations in the world. Once ALEC ratified that law, they helped push it into law in 24 states, almost in its entirety, and another 10 states partially. One piece of the law that hasn't been discussed is that if the defendant chooses to assert the stand your ground defense, which George Zimmerman did not do, and is found not guilty, then the family of the victim is required to pay the shooter's attorney fees and lost wages. Brendan Fisher with the Center for Media and Democracy spoke this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia about the role of ALEC in the killing of Trayvon Martin.
So the Stand Your Ground law was the law initially cited to protect George Zimmerman from arrest and prosecution last year. The attention paid to the Trayvon Martin case, for the first time, many people paid attention to these laws and recognized that they were on the books across the country. And the reason that they had spread across the country is because of ALEC. The law had passed in Florida, pushed by the NRA in 2005. A few weeks later, it was brought to ALEC, adopted by the corporate and legislative members of the Criminal Justice Task Force, which included Walmart as the task force co-chair. Walmart, perhaps not coincidentally, is the nation's largest seller of rifles and ammunition. Soon after ALEC adopted Stand Your Ground as a model bill, it spread across the country. And Trayvon Martin was one victim of the Stand Your Ground legislation, but there are many, many others, many other people who were killed and whose killers got off or were never arrested in the first place because these laws were on the books. And I think more recently, many people have said that Stand Your Ground was no longer an issue in the Zimmerman trial after he actually was arrested, but that's not really the case. If you look at the jury instructions, the instructions that the judge gave the jury for how they were to decide Zimmerman's fate, they basically took the Stand Your Ground law almost verbatim and instructed them that Stand Your Ground, the fact that Florida has the Stand Your Ground law in the books, is something you must consider when deciding whether to convict George Zimmerman. And in the future, in the next few weeks or months, if Trayvon Martin's family does try bringing a civil suit for the wrongful death of their son, Stand Your Ground could again come into effect. Zimmerman could invoke the Stand Your Ground law in the civil trial to not only potentially protect him from liability, but if he is successful, it would mean that Trayvon Martin's family would actually have to pay his legal fees, which is really shocking, and it would just add even more salt to these already open wounds.
That was Brendan Fisher with the Center for Media and Democracy.
Portland's local Occupy movement has begun a new protest at Mount Tabor Reservoir. The action began on Friday and is ongoing, with some of the demonstrators vowing to occupy the park around the reservoir until the city agrees to protect its own open reservoirs. The protest is co-sponsored by Friends of the Reservoirs, the Montevilla Neighborhood Association, Occupy Portland, and Camp Cascadia. The protesters at Mount Tabor are challenging the city's decision to stop fighting a federal mandate requiring the city to cover its open reservoirs. Covering the reservoirs will cost the city nearly $300 million, at a time when Portland has struggled to cut $20 million from its budget. Three people have been arrested so far at the protest for posting signs and pitching a tent. I'm joined on the phone now by Adam, one of the occupiers of Mount Tabor. Thank you for speaking with me today on KABU, Adam.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
So can you tell me what's happening at the Occupy Mount Tabor right now?
Yeah, so right now we got about 30 people out here, a lot of people standing on the edge of 60th Avenue, just off of Hawthorne, holding signs, basically, raising awareness among people passing by and the neighbors, and also calling on the city to find a solution other than closing the reservoirs and, essentially creating, what we feel is insecurity in the water system of Portland that will lead to higher rates and more chemicals in the water.
Certainly. Well, what's been the response so far to your presence in the park and that of the other protesters?
We have had overwhelmingly positive responses from the neighborhood. We've had people come out from surrounding houses and join us. We've had offers from a couple of different houses bordering Mount Tabor that have just happened by the protest to use their kitchen to cook meals. We've had a couple of people who, drive by and give the, requisite thumbs down or whatever. But overwhelmingly, the support has just been positive. And people, I think, really are understanding that this is a huge issue for Portland now and into the future.
Certainly. When was your involvement, your own? When did you start getting involved up at Mount Tabor?
So I got involved with doing the food for Friday and Saturday for the initial 2 days at Camp Cascadia. I do work with Food Not Bombs, with Portland Food Not Bombs, and I decided that I wanted to come out here and bring out food for the protesters, for people who are going to be standing out here in the sun for hours on end, and just, do that as a way to show solidarity. So, I did that initially the first 2 days. And now I'm just here. I'm not doing a food action today, but I'm here to hold a sign, to lend support, to speak to anybody who comes by who, maybe doesn't know quite what's going on, wants a little bit more information.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. What would be the best way if there's residents either listening on the radio right now or if they live in the area, what would be the best way for them to learn more about what's happening up there at Mount Tabor?
Sure. So there's a couple of websites I would direct them to. If they want information about this specific action, campcascadia.org is a great place to start. Camp Cascadia also has a Facebook page that's being updated regularly. And to learn more about this issue, the website that I have found to have some of the most hard-hitting information is bullrunwaiver.org. And there's also a bullrunwaiver.org Facebook page, and I believe it's bullrunwaiverspace.org is the Facebook page. And there's a lot of really great information on there about what closing the reservoirs will, what effects it will have on the water supply, and also the health benefits of open reservoir systems, and really what people can do to get involved, beyond coming out to the park and beyond this action.
Okay, that's wonderful news to hear, Adam. Before I let you go, what would be the best place if people wanted to actually know your location? Where are you guys located right now physically?
Right. So we are in front of Reservoir Number 6, which is completely drained. It's on the corner of 60th and Hawthorne. If anybody comes to the corner of 60th and Hawthorne, from there spreading south a few blocks, we have people lined up around the street. We have Cascadian flags with the Doug Fir flying everywhere. We have people with signs. So coming to 60th and Hawthorne, you'll see immediately all the festivities. It won't be hard to miss. And we will be out here from 5 until 12:01 a.m., 5 until midnight, every day until we get some traction from the city on this issue.
All right, Adam. Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with us here at KABU today. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
The Lower Columbia Estuary Partnership is launching a $1 million restoration project this week in the Columbia River Gorge. The project will attempt to restore floodplains created by the construction of I-84. It will also make the Oneonta and Horsetail River habitats, which were originally damaged by construction, again hospitable to fish species. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are also starting another restoration project along I-84 at the mouth of the Sandy. The goal of this $1.1 million project is to restore the Sandy to its original course and restore salmon habitat.
A Portland commission approved a $300 million plan to develop on West Hayden Island last Wednesday. The Sustainability and Planning Commission voted 7-3 in favor of the plan. The plan will be sent to the Portland City Council for approval. It includes the construction of a 300-acre deep marine terminal. The decision came after 1 week after the plan to fund the Columbia River crossing collapsed. That collapse has limited transportation access to the island and created concern amongst its residents and environmentalist groups. KBOO's Stephen Charrett spoke with Bob Salinger, the conservation director from Portland Audubon Society, for more.
One of the things I think folks need to keep in mind is that this process has been underway for 5 years, but the city was caught completely blindsided by the demise of the CRC. And, you know, there's absolutely no excuse in the world for them not to see that coming. To bank entirely on the CRC going forward was completely irresponsible. But they did, and so what happened was they found themselves scrambling literally at the last minute. They released amendments at 6 o'clock in the evening the night before the hearing. So literally 20 hours before the hearing, they produced some amendments to try and address the CRC. And the way they did it was basically they said, well, we'll move forward with annexation, but we won't move forward with the intergovernmental agreement or the zoning until later on. What that means is that the port's getting what it wants. It's getting annexation, but the community is not assured of getting the mitigation and the various other things that were going to be put in place to ensure that the project wouldn't completely destroy the environment and the livability of the local community.
So you don't think that IGA, that intergovernmental agreement, will prove to be a viable means in addressing the impacts of developing on West Hayden Island?
Well, the whole IGA presumes that the CRC is going to happen. And so all of the mitigation that's being proposed, for example, for air quality impacts or for transportation impacts, assumes that the CRC is in place. If it's not in place, those remedies are absolutely inadequate. We know the traffic is going to be much, much worse than was predicted by the modeling that was done. We know that air quality is going to be much, much worse than it was predicted by the modeling that was done. You know, an IGA that was inadequate to begin with now has become even more inadequate. The IGA, even if it is implemented, is nowhere near sufficient to address the problems that are going to occur. And because of the last-minute amendments that were made, there's no assurances that IGA is ever going to be implemented at all. So I think the community was really hung out to dry by this process.
And the next step in the process is a vote at the City Council, which...
Yes, City Council needs to vote on it next. What we're hearing is it's likely to go to City Council in the fall. The mayor has put himself on record several times stating that it would be irresponsible to make a decision on West Staten Island until we really understand what's happening with the CRC. Now that the CRC has imploded, you know, we hope the mayor really stays true to those statements. He said that both before and after the election. And I don't think the mayor at this point can make a straight-faced argument that you can simply move forward with the plan as adopted.
And your organization, the Audubon Society, is going to continue to fight this process. Is there something individuals can do?
Absolutely. We're going to need a lot of community opposition. There's already been a tremendous amount of opposition, but as the Planning Commission showed, they're still willing to ignore that and proceed forward. So we're going to have to be even more aggressive about it going forward. It's critical that City Council hear from the public. So writing City Commissioners, we have a Facebook page that we keep people updated on really a daily basis, Save West Hayden Island on Facebook. There's also a lot of information on Audubon's website about Hayden Island, but it's absolutely critical that City Council hear from public that they want this really irreplaceable natural area permanently protected. There are other places to put marine terminals. It's absolutely outrageous that we're going to destroy an irreplaceable natural area at a time when current port facilities are underutilized, when the port is sitting on vacant land that it can't use because it hasn't cleaned up its Superfund pollution, and at a time when other Columbia River ports are turning to coal and oil trains and LNG to fill their vacant lands. What we really need is a comprehensive, collaborative strategy for all of the Columbia River ports to maximize the use of the existing land base and promote sustainable industries. Instead, what we're getting is irresponsible development of incredibly valuable natural areas, while other ports turn to, again, you know, oil trains and coal and LNG in desperation to fill their vacant land. Doesn't make any sense.
That was Portland Audubon Society's Conservation Director Bob Salinger speaking with KBOO's Stephen Charette.
Portland Judge Karen Immergut has delayed a decision due Thursday on the fate of the Right to Dream 2 homeless encampment. The encampment was established in 2011 in Portland's Chinatown. About 90 people sleep there nightly. The property owner has been fined $1,346 per month for violating recreational campground codes. In December of 2012, the Right to Dream 2 filed a suit against the city. They asked that the property not be designated as a recreational campsite and that previous fines be waived. One of the camp's founders, Ibrahim Mubarak, said on Thursday that this is a civil rights issue. We are fighting for the rights of the homeless community. We are not going anywhere.
The city of Richmond, California, may become the first municipality to pursue the use of eminent domain to provide relief for area homeowners. The strategy is among a list of recommendations outlined in the Wasted Wealth report issued in May by a coalition of housing justice groups. According to the report, reducing mortgage principal would save homeowners money, boost the economy as much as $1.7 billion, and create 1.5 million jobs nationally. Figures indicate that the estimated cost of the foreclosure crisis at over $192 billion in losses nationwide. Critics opposing the tactic include representatives from the financial services industry who contend banks will be less likely to finance loans if cities and towns use the power of eminent domain to restructure their mortgages.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast. Followed at 6 by Labor Radio, our weekly program about working people, for working people, by working people. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be hot with high temperatures in the low 90s, despite a 10% chance of rain. Nighttime lows tonight will drop to near 60 degrees.
It's 5:28, and now time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
America the beautiful, America the greatest. We're number one, right? Absolutely, naturally, and indisputably. At least, that's the theocratic pronouncement of far-right-wing nativists who are presently putting forth a dogma of American exceptionalism, using the concept as a not-to-be-questioned litmus test of your and my patriotism. Never mind that on many crucial issues of national achievements, our good old U.S. of A. has slipped a bit in recent years, and a simple-minded assertion that we're number one doesn't make it so. For example, in the annual rate of educational improvement, a bedrock indicator of a nation's future ability to thrive, the U.S. has tumbled to 25th. Say it loud and say it proud, we're number 25. Not only does that place us behind such education powerhouses as Germany, but also behind Latvia, Portugal, and Slovenia. Yes, America remains one of the world's richest nations, Yet, our wealth is more concentrated in the hands of a rich elite than nearly every other nation. China has more democratic distribution of riches than our society does. So does Bangladesh, the Congo, Haiti, Mexico, Nigeria, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and all but six other countries. Healthcare? We're only 38th and dead last among wealthy democracies. Our tax code is the least progressive in the industrialized world. The quality of America's infrastructure ranks a poor 25th, and in a category that not long ago was a source of great national strength and pride, the wealth of our middle class has fallen below that of 26 other nations. This is Jim Hightower saying, in the past century, America became great not by merely believing in some hocus-pocus exceptionalism, but by achieving greatness through deliberate and determined public investments in the common good. And that's our path back to being number one.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A judge in Georgia has halted the execution of Warren Lee Hill, an intellectually disabled man. Hill was condemned for the murder of his girlfriend and a fellow inmate in 1990. According to all government doctors who have examined him, Hill is intellectually disabled and therefore protected from execution by the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. His lawyer, Brian Kamer, raised two concerns about his death sentence. Kamer claimed it was a violation of the Eighth Amendment because executing an intellectually disabled person was cruel and unusual punishment. He also challenged Georgia's recent lethal injection secrecy law. The law allows Georgia correctional agencies to obtain chemicals for lethal injection in secret. Kamer claimed this was a violation of the Eighth Amendment because Hill would not know if the drug obtained was safe and reliable. Hill's execution has already been delayed twice. It was originally stalled because of a challenge to Georgia's plan to change execution methods. A later execution date was stalled because of Hill's mental health.
Senate Majority Leader Democrat Harry Reid is threatening to use a parliamentary procedure known as the nuclear option to confirm presidential nominees. Republicans in Congress are currently blocking the nomination of seven presidential nominees to federal government positions. Senate rules allow for unlimited debate over legislation or nominations. The only way to end the debating period is via a three-fifths majority vote. This means that by simply declaring their intention not to vote, a minority party of 41 senators can prevent a nomination or bill from ever coming to a vote. To change this rule requires a two-thirds majority vote. However, it is possible for the president of the Senate, the vice president, to override Senate rules with only a single majority. This is often referred to as the nuclear option. A dissenting senator can appeal the decision, but their appeal can be tabled with a simple majority. Thus, a majority party in the Senate can move to vote on nominations on legislation without a three-fifths majority. Senator Reid is threatening to use the nuclear option to confirm presidential nominees for executive branch positions that Republicans are currently blocking. Reid says the option would not remove the 61-vote requirement on judicial appointments or legislation. Minority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell said the move would be devastating to the reputation of the Senate and the majority leader. The Senate is meeting closed doors today to discuss possible compromises in order to avoid the nuclear option, but the parties appear to be at a stalemate.
A special session of the Texas Senate passed a restrictive abortion bill late Friday evening. The bill gained national attention in late June when Senator Wendy Davis undertook an 11th-hour filibuster. Governor Rick Perry called a special session to reintroduce the bill on July 1st. The bill bans abortions after 20 weeks, restricts abortion providers, and requires that abortions be performed in surgical centers. 37 of the 42 Texas clinics providing abortions will have to close due to the new requirements. A crowd of more than 2,000 protested at the Capitol as the votes were being collected. Hallie Boaz, an organizer of Rise Up Texas, told Common Dreams that a reproductive justice movement has been born. Texas is fighting back and will not be silenced. Police were called in to clear the protesters armed with tasers, and 12 protesters were arrested. The bill will now head to the desk of Governor Rick Perry for final approval. A rally is planned for 6 p.m. tonight at Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland to protest the Texas Senate decision.
Brazil may require global internet service providers to store domestic communications data in the country. The decision came after reports of spying by the U.S. National Security Agency and Central Intelligence Agency, including data from emails, phone calls, and other data collected from Brazil and other Latin American countries. Brazil's communication minister told a Sao Paulo newspaper over the weekend that he wants companies to keep their data in the country so that it can only be available to Brazil's justice system if they request it. Silva spoke about the potential change after it was revealed that the U.S. has been spying on communications in Brazil. The Brazilian justice system cannot access their own domestic communications data because it is stored on servers outside Brazil. The minister stated that it is a matter of national security. Having data stored abroad leaves it vulnerable to unauthorized surveillance data. Brazil plans to invest in a national internet network that would provide internet, would require internet providers rather to maintain a data center in Brazil. They are also planning to push for reforms that would shift control of the global communication system from the United States to the United Nations.
A Chinese court in the southern province of Hunan has compensated a Chinese mother for an official act of injustice. Tang Hui's case began when her 11-year-old daughter was kidnapped and raped last year. The criminals were prosecuted and convicted, but Tang came forward and publicly demanded a harsher punishment. Courts reacted to Tang's protest by sentencing her to forced labor. Tang's compensation for this was small, but is symbolically significant because it represents the first challenge to the Communist Party's frequent use of forced labor to silence dissenters. Criminals and dissenters are often sent to forced labor camps for up to 4 years without any trial.
Congolese soldiers and members of the M23 rebel group clashed today for a second day in a row. The Congolese army claims it has killed 120 M23 rebels in the fighting. The raging battle began in a small village outside of Goma, the Congolese capital. It was sparked when 100 fighters from Rwanda arrived in the area disguised in women's clothing. International distress over the situation in Congo has increased since M23 seized control of Goma in November. The group is connected to Tutsi rebels that the Rwandan army supported in the 1990s. The groups were chasing Rwandan Hutus that had propagated the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Since the 90s, these rebel groups have become increasingly violent towards the Congolese military. Violence has also erupted along the Congolese-Ugandan border in the north. More than 6,000 Congolese refugees have fled to Uganda to escape battling rebel groups. UN troops estimate that more than 1 million civilians have died in the decades-long Congolese conflict.
Egyptian leaders have frozen the assets of 14 Islamist groups. The groups were allies of the ousted Egyptian president Mohamed Morsi. The freeze is the latest tactic the military is using to force these groups to back down from public protests over Morsi's removal. Military officials have claimed that they want all factions involved in the new government. Yet the military has continued with the extralegal detention of Morsi. It has also ratified a new constitution without the support of Muslim groups.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, July 15, 2013. At midday on Monday, Israeli settlers attacked a Palestinian farmer from the village of Yatta near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Local sources said that a group of armed Israeli settlers from the illegal Israeli settlement of Ya'ir near Yatta attacked Omar Hoshe as he was farming his land. Hoshe sustained moderate wounds and was moved to a local hospital for treatment. Also in Hebron, Israeli soldiers manning a military checkpoint in Hebron's old city detained two Palestinian children on Monday morning. Ahmed Abdel Qader, 10, and Mohammed Abu Mayale, 7, were detained by the soldiers for several hours and were released later. The army gave no reason for detaining the two children. Today in the Gaza Strip, Israeli tanks and bulldozers invaded farmlands owned by Palestinian farmers located east of Jabalia district in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Tanks opened fire at random as bulldozers destroyed farmlands that are close to the borders. Damage but no injuries were reported. In other news, Palestinian residents of the Negev organized protests against the Israeli so-called Brefer Plan. Israeli police attacked the protesters and kidnapped 20 of them A number of injuries were also reported. If the Brafar plan is implemented, 40,000 Bedouins who live in 36 villages will lose their homes, so Israel can replace those homes with settlements and military bases. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 15th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, officials say NATO-led coalition forces attacked a group of Taliban fighters in eastern Afghanistan, killing at least five militants. The provincial police chief says his reports indicate 12 Taliban were killed, including a significant regional leader. An ISAF airstrike killed two Taliban attempting to plant a mine in the southern Kandahar province. At least five armed opposition fighters were killed in the eastern Nangarhar province by Afghan National Army Special Forces. The deaths were the result of a clearing operation aimed at taking back Taliban strongholds. There were no reports of civilian casualties in any of the conflicts. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emily Sterling, Steve Charette, Robin Ryan, Casey Decker, Kevin Duggan, and Josie Lichten. The producer is Ross Freeman-Levin. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO News and Evening Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Angelique O'Rourke. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, host Joe Uris talks about the science fiction world of his childhood and the reality of today. It's about how it all came true and how awful it really is. At 9 on Alternative Radio, economist and professor Richard Wolff speaks on democracy at work.
At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on stage and studio, filmmakers Cynthia Lopez and Juvie Hall talk to women roller derby players around the world. Join D-May for a look at their new film in progress, Flat Track, Around the World. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Danielle Knapp, associate curator of the Jordan Snitzer Museum at the University of Oregon, about current shows there, including New American Acquisitions.
Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Angelique.
Good night, John.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 15th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. In Syria today, about 200 civilians remained trapped in a mosque while fighting continued unabated outside. It's unclear if they sought safety at the mosque or were already there praying when the fighting broke out. The local coordination committees say most of those trapped are women and children. The Syrian National Coalition has appealed to the United Nations to pressure President Bashar al-Assad to allow those trapped to escape. The United Nations is also concerned about civilian safety. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Valerie Amos has called on all parties to allow safe passage for the approximately 2,500 people trapped in homes and to provide a pathway for humanitarian aid to enter the city. In Zimbabwe, two-day early voting began yesterday, but thousands of people weren't able to vote because polling stations didn't have enough ballots. FSRN's Gerikai Chaunza is in the capital, Harare, and is monitoring the special early voting, during which security forces scheduled for duty on Election Day are allowed to cast their ballot. Nearly 30 Greenpeace activists broke into a nuclear power plant in southern France just before dawn today. They hung banners and projected messages on the darkened building, calling on President François Hollande to keep last year's campaign promise to dramatically reduce France's dependence on nuclear power. FSRN's Liam Moriarty has more.
The Tricastin facility, located about 95 miles north of Marseille, is France's third oldest nuclear plant, and Greenpeace calls it one of the five most dangerous in the country. The group was inside the plant for more than 3 hours before police moved in to make arrests. A few hours later, all 29 activists had been removed. Greenpeace spokesperson Sophia Magnoni says the action was meant to remind President Hollande he's done little toward cutting the share of France's electricity that comes from nuclear from 75% to 50%.
He has to be more courageous. He has to fight against the nuclear lobby, and he has to announce more nuclear reactor closure if he wants to keep his commitment.
This is the latest of several times in the last couple of years that Greenpeace has broken into nuclear facilities to dramatize what they say are the security and safety risks of France's heavy reliance on nuclear power. In one action last year, an activist in a hang glider flew over a plant and dropped a smoke bomb to highlight the plant's vulnerability to terrorist attack. Liam Moriarty, FSRN, Normandy, France.
Despite widespread public opposition, a new nuclear power station in India went online over the weekend. Shurya Niazi has more.
The Kudankulam nuclear power plant is expected to start producing power in the next 2 to 3 weeks. The plant reached criticality, or the point at which neutrons are balanced, on Saturday night. But an environmental group, Friends of the Earth, has filed a fresh petition in the High Court in Madras. They asked the court